Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, May 2, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss President Obama's legacy in the lower federal courts. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to today's call, Brett Shumate, he's a partner at Wiley Ryan Fielding, and Damian Schiff, he's the principal attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. They're going to give us opening remarks, but as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please be thinking of those questions. They're going to concentrate primarily on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but maybe we can talk more generally about other courts in the Q&A section. We'll know when we get there. With that, Mr. Shumate, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. I'm happy to be here today to talk about the president's appointments to the D.C. Circuit, and I think that court really has changed in the last 7 or 8 years during the Obama administration. He's had a profound impact on the ideological balance of the court and in ways that will affect litigation in that court, the jurisprudence coming out of the court, and for many years to come. The D.C. Circuit has always been a court where its reputation has been a place where you can get rigorous review of executive action. And I think that reputation remains true. It's still a place where litigants can expect the judges on that court to carefully scrutinize agency action for compliance with the APA and the Constitution. But I think some of the president's appointments and combined with transitions in the among the existing judges to senior status suggest the court may be taking a different approach in the future, and some of the judges may be less inclined to strike down agency action, maybe more inclined to defer to executive branch action than some of the predecessors on the D.C. Circuit. So I think I'm going to focus my remarks a little bit on the en banc review process in the D.C. Circuit, how the president's appointments have changed the approach to litigation in that court, and some of the what we can expect in the future in the D.C. Circuit. Let me give a brief overview of what the D.C. Circuit looks like today compared to what it was like in 2008 before President Obama took office. In 2008, the chief judge was Judge Sentel. There were three Democrat-appointed judges who were active on the court at the time and seven judges who were appointed by Republican presidents. So the ideological balance at the time was pretty heavily tilted toward Republican-appointed judges, 7-3. By 2016, there was a new chief judge. Judge Garland became the chief judge in 2013. And three Republican-appointed judges have taken senior status since then. Judge Sentel became senior in 2013, Judge Ginsburg in 2011, and Judge Randolph in 2008. Combine that with the president's appointments to the D.C. Circuit. He's had four appointments to the D.C. Circuit in 2013 and 14. Judges Srinivasan, Millett, and Pillard in 2013, and Judge Wilkins in 2014. So where it used to be 7-4, Republicans outnumbered Democrats on the court in 2008, today the active lineup of judges are seven judges appointed by Democrats and four judges appointed by Republican presidents. So what used to be 7-3 is now 4-7, Democrats outnumbering the Republican-appointed judges. On the inactive side, you've got six inactive judges on the court, five of whom were appointed by Republican presidents. One was appointed by a Democratic president. So you have a total of 17 judges on the court, 11 whom are active, and Democratic-appointed judges now outnumber the Republicans on the court greatly. So I think from that we can see that the president has had a significant impact on who is sitting on the D.C. Circuit and what the ideological balance is going to be, and we can talk a little bit more in depth later on about how that is affecting litigation, how that's affecting the jurisprudence of the court, and what the president's legacy is going to be in the D.C. Circuit in the future. But for now, I'll turn it over to Damian for a brief overview of what's going on in the Ninth Circuit.
Thank you very much, Brett. And I think you'll find that for everyone on the call that my general observations will be consistent with what Brett has just said in terms of the effect of President Obama's appointments in the Ninth Circuit although the main difference being that, of course, the Ninth Circuit being so much larger than the D.C. Circuit in terms of the number of judges, the relative impact will probably not be as great, at least immediately, as in the D.C. Circuit. Nevertheless, to date, President Obama has successfully appointed 7 new judges to the Ninth Circuit. Put that in perspective, there are currently 44 current judges, including senior judges on the Ninth Circuit. Again, 7 appointed by President Obama, 7 by George W. Bush, 14 by President Clinton, 2 by George H.W. Bush, 5 by President Reagan, 7 by President Carter, and still 2 serving, appointed by President Nixon. And so even before President Obama completed his 7 current appointees, the court was tilted towards the left, especially in terms of administrative and environmental law. And I think that President Obama's appointees will continue that, although with a twist, which we'll get into a little bit later in terms of particular cases that I think might well demonstrate the ideology of the particular appointees. But of the 7 whom President Obama has appointed, interestingly, 3 are not only in their 40s, but also served in the same appellate advocacy law firm in California, Munger, Tolles, and Olson. Those 3 are Michelle Friedland, Paul Watford, and John Owens. Interestingly enough, Paul Watford was discussed as a possible Supreme Court appointee before Judge Garland was nominated by President Obama earlier this year, and so I think he may be one to watch going forward for future appointments. Of the other 4, the backgrounds of the appointees are, generally speaking, a lot of government service in U.S. attorney's offices or civil litigation. In particular, I would again point out that at least 4 of the 7 have served in U.S. DOJ. Just going quickly to a couple of representative cases, in preparation for the call, I did a little research with respect to certain types of cases in environmental law that all of these 7 appointees have already addressed in their somewhat brief time having served on the Ninth Circuit, and focusing on what I consider to be the most important federal environmental laws, the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Superfund, the CERCLA law, and the Clean Air Act. And interestingly, in looking at the decisions that the Ninth Circuit has issued in which the 7 appointees have been party to, or have been either part of the majority panel or have written the opinion, one sees a few patterns emerging. Perhaps the most interesting pattern is that really none of the appointees reflects a clear sort of ideological interest in environmental law. And that's something that is different from the older, more liberal appointees on the Ninth Circuit, in particular those from the Carter administration and those from the Clinton administration, where not only do you have those judges routinely ruling in favor of environmental interests, but they also do it notwithstanding a contrary agency decision that's being reviewed. And that is a big distinction from what I've observed with President Obama's appointees. More often than not, they'll be on the side of environmental interests, but only because that happens to be, in a particular case, what the government itself had already decided and what the action was at issue. So, for example, I think, let's see here. I think a good example to start off with would be, in sort of a contrary sense, I think a good example to start off with would be a fairly significant decision of the Ninth Circuit called Organized Village of Kake versus Department of Agriculture. This was issued about a year and a half ago concerning the roadless rule as applied to national forests in Alaska. The roadless rule was one of the last major policy, environmental policy decisions of the Clinton administration that tried to limit substantially timber harvesting and other protective activity in the national forest generally, and in particular in the Tongass National Forest in Alaska. The roadless rule was challenged, and the administration, when it changed to the Bush administration, the roadless rule was basically, the policy was reversed, and the Bush administration decided we don't want to put so many areas off of productive activity. And that policy reversal was challenged by a number of environmental organizations as well as some native villages in Alaska. And it was that issue that the Ninth Circuit addressed in the Village of Kake case. And there, interestingly enough, in bank, in an opinion written by Judge Hurwitz, who is one of President Obama's new appointees, held that the Department of Agriculture, in reversing the roadless rule policy, had acted arbitrarily and capriciously and remanded the case to the agency for further action. That's a significant decision because not only was it in bank by Judge Hurwitz, but it was joined also by Judge Kristen, who was another new Obama appointee from Alaska, who specifically concurred to note that her decision was not improperly motivated for environmental reasons, but simply was a natural application of administrative law. The reason why she wrote separately is because the in-bank decision garnered a significant dissent from Judge Milan Smith, who was a George W. Bush appointee. But interestingly there, he was joined by Judge Murguia, one of the first of the Obama appointees to ascend to the Ninth Circuit. And so we can see that later on the call. I can mention a few other cases, but we can see that even among the appointees that President Obama has appointed to the Ninth Circuit, there has been a significant, it has not been a significant, consistently significant approach in favor of, say, environmental law. Rather, it's been more of a default to whatever the agencies are doing. And in the rare instances where an agency is overturned, there is not even unanimity among the appointees as to whether, in fact, that was an appropriate exercise of judicial review or whether it was instead insufficiently deferential to the agency decision-making. So with that little introduction, I'll turn it back over to Dean for any questions.
Terrific. I want to open the floor to questions. I do have a question myself, but let's open the floor and see if callers have questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to your questions momentarily. Let me ask Brett Shumate, what you mentioned the numbers. I wonder if you could talk about the caseload in particular of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and their administrative law decisions, and then also what the effect of the numbers changes that you mentioned, what effect that might have on litigation going forward. And before you answer that, a reminder to our callers, the lines are open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Mr. Shumate.
Thank you, Dean. Actually, something that Damian mentioned kind of triggered something in my mind as well about, you know, what are the backgrounds of the new Obama appointees to the D.C. Circuit? And interestingly enough, three out of the four have past experience at DOJ. Judges Srinivasan and Patty Millett were in the SG's office here in Washington. Judge Pillard, I believe, was in the Office of Legal Counsel during the Obama administration. So the three of them obviously have lots of administrative law expertise, have been around it. It's not new to them. So they are well prepared to, you know, handle any type of administrative law case that may come through the D.C. Circuit. Judge Wilkins, by contrast, I don't believe he has any DOJ experience, but he was a former trial judge here in D.C. as well. So a very well-qualified crop of appointees to handle the type of cases that the D.C. Circuit typically handles, which are regulatory challenges to agency action. The D.C. Circuit, like I said, has had a reputation for giving close scrutiny to agency action, and I think that reputation will continue. They hear all kinds of administrative law cases, primarily because of the agency sitting in the District of Columbia. But interestingly enough, in terms of where cases may be brought in the future, I think the appointment will affect where cases are brought in the future. Damien is handling and talking about cases out of the Ninth Circuit. You know, not every administrative law case comes through the D.C. Circuit. Litigants often have a choice of challenging agency action in D.C. or where they reside. So I think one of the effects you will likely see as a result of these appointments to the D.C. Circuit is litigants are going to start choosing other fora in which to bring their petitions for review or district court actions to enjoin agency action. Right now, I think the Fifth and the Eighth Circuits are really attractive options to bring cases challenging agency action. The president has not had as many appointments to those courts. The Republican senators in those states have placed a lot of holds on Obama appointees or nominees to those courts, so he has not been as successful in getting appointments through those courts as in some other courts. For example, the current case at the Supreme Court involving deferred action, the immigration case challenging the president's executive order, that came out of Texas. The case was brought in Texas by the state. It went through the Fifth Circuit. Now it's at the Supreme Court. So I think you're going to see more cases like that being brought in the regional circuits outside of Washington, just because I think litigants are concerned about the new appointments and how that will change the ideological balance of the court and what the chances will be for en banc review in that court. So, I think in the average administrative law case, I think the D.C. Circuit will continue to see a large chunk of the administrative law docket throughout the country. But in really high-profile cases where litigants do have a choice of which forum and which to bring the case, I think you're going to start to see cases being brought in the Fifth and the Eighth Circuits and potentially other circuits as well. I think another effect of these appointments will be, in the garden variety case that you're involved in, it's going to affect the panel that hears your case. In 2008, you were statistically most likely to have two judges on your panel that were appointed by Republican presidents. In today, I think you're more likely to have two judges appointed by Democrats and one judge appointed by a Republican who may be active or who may be a senior judge. So I think in every case that's being heard today, I think the turnover in the judges on that court is going to affect the panel that's going to hear your case. And finally, I think another effect of these appointments is going to affect the prospects for en banc review and Supreme Court review in the Supreme Court. So, for example, if you get a bad decision or an adverse decision from the D.C. Circuit, you're going to have to look and evaluate who's on the en banc court before advising your client whether to seek en banc review or potentially go seek Supreme Court review. And so, if it's a high-profile case where you predict Republican judges may have been more favorable to your side, en banc review may not be as palatable of an option today as it used to be in 2008. So I think there are going to be a lot of practical effects in how litigation is brought as a result of these appointments, both where the cases are brought, who's going to be hearing the case that you're involved in, and how it affects litigation strategy after you receive a decision from the D.C. Circuit. So I can speak a little bit later about how these judges have used the en banc process to affect the jurisprudence of the court and how that might affect litigation challenges and opportunities in the future.
Damien Schiff, do you have anything on this point?
Yeah, I would also add in terms of the decisions about where to file. One of the things that the Ninth Circuit, of course, has so much environmental litigation because the vast majority of the nation's public lands are in the Ninth Circuit's jurisdiction. And so generally speaking, for a litigant say if you are a user of national forests, you need a timber harvester, or say you have you graze livestock through a permit from the Bureau of Land Management or from the Forest Service. Basically, your options are either the Ninth Circuit, because geographically that's where your property or the area is located, or perhaps in the D.C. Circuit. Now, as Brett just mentioned, the D.C. Circuit itself has changed such that for a property owner or for someone who wants to vindicate a property-related interest as opposed to an environmental concern, really things aren't that great, because the Ninth Circuit continues to be generally unfavorable to any government challenge, in particular a government challenge that can be painted as a green decision. And now the D.C. Circuit has sort of become something of certainly on its face, no more attractive than the Ninth Circuit, and maybe possibly even a little less attractive. So that, I think, is a concern for venue. One thing I wanted to mention, though, is interestingly enough, we've already had one decision from the Ninth Circuit written by an Obama appointee, already reversed by the Supreme Court, in fact reversed unanimously earlier this term. The case is Sturgeon versus Frost, and it concerns a somewhat obscure issue about how Alaska conservation units are regulated under federal law. Nevertheless, the Ninth Circuit in that case ruled against, essentially, if you want to call it, the property interests in that case. The opinion was written by Judge Nguyen, who was appointed by President Obama a few years ago. The Supreme Court earlier this term, in an opinion written by the Chief Justice, unanimously reversed Judge Nguyen's decision on a narrow ground, but nevertheless holding that the statutory construction that the court and the Ninth Circuit had employed was just implausible. And so that, I think, is to some extent shows that the Ninth Circuit is continuing, even with these new Obama appointees, and even with perhaps a change in the Supreme Court, nevertheless, there still seems to be a disjunct between the two courts on interpreting statutes and in environmental issues in particular.
Once again, we're in the Q&A portion of our program. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller question, so let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is Will Hahn. I wanted to ask a question about what the panelists think about President Obama's judicial nominees and what they say about President Obama's own view of the courts. It was mentioned earlier on the call that some of his nominees to the Ninth Circuit, for example, don't evince an obvious sort of ideological bent towards the left. And I'm wondering if that itself may suggest something that other people have commented on about the modern liberal view of the courts as a sort of hollow hope for progressives, that the courts are essentially constrained by popular political pressure. And so instead of pursuing social change through legal decisions, as the left so often did throughout the 20th century, that the more effective means of political action is to actually organize and try to affect change through the political process. And so President Obama's priority simply isn't to nominate people who are overtly liberal to the courts. He doesn't have to. The profession has enough reflexive liberalism in it that he can just sort of rely on traditional institutional indicators of being a good lawyer, and that usually could correlate with being a reliable liberal, and that's enough, because we're not going to look to the courts to be vehicles for social change like we once did. I'm wondering if the panelists have any thoughts on this.
I was going to say, I do think that there's a good deal of truth to that. Another example from Judge Nguyen, who, again, as I say, wrote the Sturgeon decision that was reversed by the Supreme Court. She also, in a fairly recent decision, in an environmental challenge to a series of oil spill response plans that some energy companies had submitted to the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement for approval. The agency approved them. They were challenged by, as I say, these environmental groups. And she basically, applying Chevron and in a very deferential approach to agency decision-making, said, these are fine, and rejected the environmentalist challenge over a rather strong dissent from the denial of rehearing in bank authored by Judge Nelson, Judge Dorothy Nelson, who is who's been serving on the Ninth Circuit for some time and was appointed by a Democratic president. And so I think that is a good example of how you can see this generational shift, that the newer Democratic appointees are certainly liberal, but they tend to reveal their liberalism more in their deference to the government. Now, you could say, well, if the government substantially changes and is no longer in its decision-making as liberal as it has been, maybe you would see a less deferential approach. But nevertheless, you do have that distinction. Another point, or another example I might add, is, again, in concerning environmental law, the Ninth Circuit a few years ago upheld California's low carbon fuel standard, which is basically a greenhouse gas related issue. And a collection of out-of-state energy companies had challenged that standard under the Dormant Commerce Clause. And Judge Gould, writing for the panel of the Ninth Circuit, a Democratic appointee, not surprisingly perhaps, upheld the greenhouse gas standard against the Dormant Commerce Clause challenge. But remarkably, Judge Murguia, who is an Obama appointee and who was appointed to a district court position prior to that by President Clinton, she wrote a dissent and said that she thought that the low-carbon fuel standard was facially discriminatory against interstate commerce and therefore was unconstitutional. So, you know, I think just two examples are not necessarily statistically decisive, but I do think that they show that you cannot expect that every appointee, at least in terms of issues of environmental and administrative law, is going to be as strong of a liberal, say, as in the Ninth Circuit you would think of someone like Stephen Reinhart or Harry Pregerson, who do go back to the Carter years and who have a long history of being consistently and strongly in favor of certain liberal positions, so to speak. That attitude, for whatever reason, does not yet seem to be evincing itself in the in President Obama's more recent Ninth Circuit appointees.
Yeah, this is Brett. Let me just piggyback off of what Damian said, and Will, I think that's a great question. Focusing on the D.C. Circuit, I think there's three things that strike me when I look at the president's appointments to the D.C. Circuit and what he was looking for and hoping to accomplish. Obviously, as we all remember, there was a lot of controversy over the appointments to the D.C. Circuit. Senator Reid broke the Senate to break the filibuster to try to get these judges on the court. So it really was a political exercise to get these judges confirmed. So I think what the president was trying to do was offer up judges who were extremely qualified, number one. Number two, who had worked in the administration, so they had, to some extent, were known quantities and were inclined to the view of one who has worked in government and understands the work of executive branch agencies. And then third, he was looking to diversify the federal bench. He's appointed two women to the D.C. Circuit and two diverse men to the D.C. Circuit as well. So I think that's what he was looking for, and he succeeded and accomplished getting four judges through on the D.C. Circuit who I really do think will affect the ideological balance of the court. Turn it back to you, Dean.
Yes, once again, we're in the Q&A portion of our program. The lines are wide open right now. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a question of either or maybe both of our experts. You can maybe debate this. Which is the – if you wanted to bring a challenge to an agency action, an APA challenge or any other sort of challenge, would you be better served in the district – in the Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit or the Ninth Circuit?
This is Brett. From my perspective, I think it would probably depend on the type of case. If it's more of a run-of-the-mill agency action type case, I think you might well be served in the D.C. Circuit because you can expect those judges will be familiar with the type of case that you have, will give it a careful scrutiny. If it doesn't have any ideological bent, you're better served. You've got a good chance. I think procedural type arguments, notice and comment, rulemaking arguments are probably your best bet to try to get a victory in the D.C. Circuit. I think you're less likely to get a win on Chevron statutory authority type grounds. So if that's the, kind of the focus of your challenge, you might consider looking at another circuit. Damien, for the opposite view, what do you think about potentially taking – what kinds of cases would you take outside of the D.C. Circuit?
Well, that's a very timely question, and I think the one concern is, as you just mentioned, Brett, about Chevron, because it seems like in the Ninth Circuit in particular, there is a strong movement to defer to agency decision-making, and not just in terms of the Chevron issue of a statutory interpretation, but also just in terms of the larger question of agency expertise and technical and scientific determinations, which are very common in the environmental law context. I've noticed that recent appointees in the Ninth Circuit, whether from the George W. Bush administration or the Obama administration, routinely like to defer to agency decision-making, not just in terms of the statutory interpretation, but also in terms of record issues. And that is an issue that I think the Ninth Circuit diverges somewhat from the D.C. Circuit. In my experience, I think you might get a little more searching of a review in the D.C. Circuit. Now, interestingly enough, there are a fair number of cases usually litigated by property interests concerning environmental law in the D.C. Circuit because of venue shopping at the time, thinking that, well, the Ninth Circuit is already bad. Why don't we try our hand in the D.C. Circuit? And sometimes that has succeeded, although perhaps most prominently when the D.C. Circuit a few years ago upheld the constitutionality of the Endangered Species Act against a Commerce Clause challenge, which merited the dissent from rehearing by then-Judge Roberts and his famous hapless toad comment. So you could say that it's been tough slogging for property interests for a while in either court, but I do think that if it is a question that you need a little more searching review of your record, you're probably going to find, relatively speaking, a better venue in the D.C. Circuit than in the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, this is Brett, to respond to that as well. I think if you've got a case where you think the agency is just well beyond its statutory authority, or it's shocking what the agency has done and your client is outraged by it, bringing that in the D.C. Circuit might get lost in the shuffle because they see so many administrative law cases. Yes, you will get searching review in your case, and you can feel confident in that, but what you think is shocking may not appear to be shocking to D.C. Circuit judges that see these types of agency cases all the time. But if you get to outside of D.C., to the Fifth or Eighth Circuits, for example, who hear some admin law cases, but nothing like the D.C. Circuit, your arguments that the agency is acting ultra vires or agency behaving badly may appear to fall on better ears than in the D.C. Circuit, where judges might hear those arguments all the time. So that's another thing to keep in mind. I think it's a case-specific analysis, but those are the things I think you would want to consider before deciding to go outside the D.C. Circuit.
We do have another listener with a question, and we'll turn to that momentarily. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Yes, this is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society, and I want to follow up on the question that Will had asked earlier about whether or not essentially this administration has simply moved further than the judicial branch is willing to go in using executive and administrative action. It does not appear to me, at least, that the administration has any plans to submit the Paris Climate Treaty for ratification by the Senate. If that case were ever litigated, chances are perhaps that the Supreme Court would insist that a treaty ought to be ratified by the Senate. It seems when you look at the NLRB recess appointment cases that for a period of months or longer, the administration simply gambled and had the board issue its decisions. And the question of whether the courts ultimately were going to hold that the Senate just didn't have any idea at all when it was in recess and when it wasn't, and that the White House would determine that. I don't think there was ever a likelihood that ultimately the courts would go that far, the Supreme Court would go that far. And so as a policy choice and as a political choice, with its immigration policy, also the administration has simply bypassed the courts and kind of raced ahead, waiting for the courts to try to catch up and perhaps correct mistakes or errors along the way. So is it not just that this administration is content to fill judicial vacancies with kind of plain vanilla, if somewhat more diverse, nominees, but rather that the political force in the administration is simply going through the executive branch now, and that, as with Congress, that the executive branch is simply going to defy the courts until it gets caught, until the case is brought before the court and a decision is made. So that takes it a little bit further than Will's question did.
Yeah, this is Brett. I'll take a quick stab at responding. I think it's a great question and it has a great observation in it. And I think the reason the president spent the political capital on getting forward new judges to the D.C. Circuit is because the Democrats are aware of how important the judges are and the courts are to sustaining agency action. We've seen the lengths the president and his administration is willing to go to expand the scope of administrative authority. And I think conservatives have always understood the importance of judges and having judges who are committed to the rule of law and restraining agencies that are outside the scope of their authority. And I think the Democrats have really understood that lesson and taken it to heart during this administration and spent the political capital to appoint judges to the courts, especially the D.C. Circuit, that are crucial in reviewing executive action from this president. So no doubt judges play a pivotal political role in our system, and this president has spent the capital to get judges on important courts, and you can see the importance of and the effect that has had in the D.C. Circuit. They've had at least three Affordable Care Act type cases that have come through that court and gone to the en banc court, and the new Obama appointments have swung the balance in those cases, and I think it's likely that if President Obama had not accomplished those four appointments to the D.C. Circuit, the outcomes in the Halbig case, which was an Affordable Care Act case, Priest for Life, which is now pending at the Supreme Court, and the Sissel case, all Affordable Care Act cases that went en banc or were stymied from en banc because of the new appointments may have come out differently. And so that's a concrete example where I think you can see the effect that these appointments have had on the jurisprudence of the D.C. Circuit. I think those cases likely would have come out differently, and that's exactly what the president was hoping to accomplish when he made these appointments. Damian?
And I would say that I think for the Ninth Circuit, I'm sure that President Obama, his goal was in part just simply to continue what has traditionally been a liberal jurisprudence from that circuit, particularly in terms of administrative and environmental law. And as I mentioned earlier, I think by and large his appointees are doing that, although not necessarily because they have a great allegiance to the underlying values that are being vindicated by these environmental statutes, for example, but rather simply because they're willing to okay what the agencies are doing. Plus, you have an interesting dynamic in that, in a sense, a victory for the environmental interest is simply not doing anything. And so oftentimes what you have are private property interests that are trying to change the status quo. And, of course, their task is doubly hard because not only is the change of the status quo against the environmental interest that generally is supported in the Ninth Circuit, but it's also challenging a decision of the agency to keep the status quo, which also is going to be viewed dimly, not just by the Democratic appointees, but also by the Republican appointees on that circuit. So I think that the same phenomena that that Brett mentioned in the D.C. Circuit are also being played out in the Ninth Circuit to a somewhat lesser extent.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, so let's carry on. Caller, you might have your telephone on mute. You might need to take yourself off mute if you've muted your own phone.
Ooh, sorry about that. Hi, I'm Ray Nahn. I am Damien's colleague at the Pacific Legal Foundation. I have a two-part question. So with the appointment of these new judges on the D.C. Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, have we seen the judges adopt more extreme positions, those that are more likely to be overruled or overturned by the Supreme Court? And if a new Democratic president is elected this year, do you think that there is a more likelihood that these judges would adopt more extreme positions that would be reversed at the Supreme Court? Have these judges given any indication about how far their jurisprudence really extends?
Well, this is Damien. I can take that first. Thanks, Ray, for the question. I think on the first point in whether they have been reversed, as I mentioned earlier in the call, in the Sturgeon v. Frost case, that was a unanimous Supreme Court reversing an Obama appointee's opinion on the scope of federal authority over federal lands in Alaska. And that is a surprising decision because if you read the Ninth Circuit decision, it doesn't seem particularly outrageous, and yet nevertheless the Supreme Court thought it was clearly wrong. Another case that just popped into my head, not dealing with environmental law, but rather with the Fourth Amendment, written by Judge Watford, who was another Obama appointee, in-bank decision from the Ninth Circuit last year, holding that the Fourth Amendment does protect hotel operators who don't want to convey their hotel registry to the police without an administrative warrant first. That decision was upheld in the Patel case from last year in the Supreme Court, a divided Supreme Court decision, upholding, though, Judge Watford's in-bank decision, reaching the same result from the Ninth Circuit. And so I think it depends upon the judge, and it's hard to say at this point whether there will be, among the new crop of Obama appointees, the same disjunct that we have seen traditionally between the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court. I suspect with Justice Scalia's death and with his replacement, perhaps that dynamic will change and we'll have the Supreme Court that's a little closer in tune to the Ninth Circuit, and thus perhaps fewer of these reversals.
Yeah, this is Brett. Just to expand on that a little bit, I think it's a really interesting psychological question. How will the D.C. Circuit rule in cases, especially en banc cases, with a Supreme Court that doesn't have Justice Scalia on it right now? If there's a hugely important ideological case that the liberals on the court and in the D.C. Circuit decide en banc, Supreme Court review is less of a threat or less of a check because a tie at the Supreme Court affirms the judgment below. So, we all like to think that judges decide cases in vacuums, but they don't. They're aware of what's happening around them. And I think it's an interesting question how that might affect the psychology of a judge deciding a case where, the prospect of Supreme Court review, at least on the on the conservative side, with having lost Justice Scalia, is less of a check on potentially more liberal decision in the Court of Appeals. So.
Looks like we lost our next question. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are once again wide open. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask a question about the workloads of the respective courts. One of the things I remember hearing when President Obama had some nominees pending before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, was that there was no need for additional judges in the court given its caseload. And then that's for Brett Shumate. With regard to the Ninth Circuit, I'm wondering from Damien Schiff what the caseload is there, given the number of judges. Is there still a movement to try and split the circuit? Is that seriously being discussed? Brett Schumate, you want to go first on the caseload in the D.C. Court of Appeals?
Sure. My experience is having clerked on the Fifth Circuit, where the caseload was really heavy on immigration cases and criminal cases, and that really jacked up the workload of the entire court. You don't really have that so much in the D.C. Circuit, so you've got fewer cases with less merit, but you have more cases probably with more merit. So overall, I think you'll see that the D.C. Circuit probably has the lowest number of cases pending of any court, but the cases that they have are really complicated and really require a lot of thought. Not that every other case pending before every other circuit court does not require a lot of thought and careful judgment, but to the extent you have to deal with 10 FERC cases per year, that's going to require a lot of brain power and a lot of thought. So I think if you look at the stats, yes, there's probably a good argument to be made that additional judges were not necessary on that court, and it could function fine without additional appointments. But I will say that the type of cases that they hear do require a lot of thought, require a lot of work and careful thinking. So the type of cases that they have are very different than what you would expect in the Fifth Circuit and probably in the Ninth Circuit as well.
And this is Damien. I would say that there, I'm not aware of any real desire to split the Ninth Circuit currently, although there have been a lot of discussions about that in the past, and I think they haven't got that far because they're always viewed as being ideologically motivated as a desire to dilute the otherwise perceived liberal force of the court's jurisprudence. In terms of caseload, I believe the Ninth Circuit has the highest caseload in the nation, in part because it is geographically such a large circuit, including the most populous state in the union. And so I think that the additional judges were, just from a caseload perspective, certainly needed. And just as Brett mentioned with respect to the Fifth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit also has a very healthy dose of immigration and criminal matters. And I think as a consequence, when you do have a fairly complicated record review case, it may, if you have just on that reason alone and you have the option, it may make more sense to try and litigate in the D.C. Circuit precisely because you'll have judges there who may be more familiar with the issues but certainly probably have more time to review the finer points of a record question than you would among judges in the Ninth Circuit.
Let me make a final call for questions. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. Gentlemen, I don't see – it appears we've had our final question, so why don't we I might come back to each of you in the order we began and give you a chance to express a final thought here. Brett Schumate.
Sure. Thank you, Dean. It's been a privilege to talk about this issue today. Just three kind of concluding points about what is the legacy of the Obama appointments on the D.C. Circuit. And just three points. I think, as I've said a couple of times here, the four appointments to the D.C. Circuit have really shifted the ideological balance of the court dramatically from a Republican-dominated court to a democratically-dominated court, whereas in 2008 there were only three Democrats and seven Republicans. Today there are seven Democrats and four Republicans. So I think that has greatly affected the types of cases that will be heard en banc by the court and will greatly change the types of and backgrounds of the judges that hear your case when it comes before them. I think the judges on the court now overall are generally more inclined to defer to agencies when they are at a time expanding their power into new areas. I think we're still likely to see those judges on the court giving very rigorous review to agency action. But like I said, more likely to defer and less likely to question the motives of agency decision makers. Whereas before, I think the court overall was probably viewed as skeptical of agency action into new areas. I think the second point, just to wrap up, would be that I think we'll see more high-profile administrative law cases being brought in regional circuits, like Texas brought the immigration challenge to the president's executive order in Texas, came through the Fifth Circuit, and now it's at the Supreme Court, especially given the fact that a divided Supreme Court now without Justice Scalia would result in affirming the judgment below. I think that's another reason why you might see decisions being brought in some regional circuits where you're more likely to get two Republicans on a panel rather than two Democrats on a panel. And finally, I think what we've seen at the D.C. Circuit is a good indication of what could happen at the Supreme Court with the vacancy of Justice Scalia. The four appointments by the president to the D.C. Circuit have definitely affected the outcome of en banc cases in the last couple of years involving the Affordable Care Act, and I think conservatives are right to be concerned about a new appointment by the president to the Supreme Court, given his success in changing the ideological makeup of the D.C. Circuit.
Damien Schiff, a final thought?
Thank you. Thank you, Dean. Thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum today. And I would say, first of all, picking up on what Brett just said, I think we're already seeing a desire to litigate some otherwise sort of D.C. circuit-worthy cases in regional circuits, in addition to the immigration case that Brett mentioned. There's also the challenge to the Waters of the United States rule, which is currently pending in the Sixth Circuit. And in fact, actually, the Sixth Circuit has already issued a favorable preliminary injunction or stay of that otherwise fairly important Obama administration environmental regulation. And I think that in part why we're in the Sixth Circuit as opposed to the D.C. Circuit may be for the reasons that Brett just articulated. Going back to the Ninth Circuit, though, I would say the main takeaway is that essentially the types of people who are being appointed by the president to the Ninth Circuit are not really different from those who have been appointed, say, to the D.C. Circuit. The difference is that whereas the baseline at the D.C. Circuit was generally favorable to sort of the Republican side of the political spectrum, in the Ninth Circuit the baseline was just the other way, that it was already tilting Democratic, and I think that the president's recent appointees to that court will simply continue that ideological orientation for the foreseeable future, with the caveat, as I noted before, that a particular judge among those appointees may decide to buck the trend, so to speak, particularly where it's a question of deferring to an agency decision, even if that agency decision may not be vindicating particular environmental or other liberal values.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. This has been a very interesting conversation. I thank you both on behalf of the Federal Society. One closing observation I'll offer, of course, when the winds blow one way or another affecting lower courts, it sounds like the litigants are free to engage in a little forum shopping, a little forum choice by going to bring a case in a different circuit. Of course, with replacement of a justice on the Supreme Court, that's the court of last resort, so there is no way around that court, I suppose. With that, I thank you both, and I want to thank the audience also for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to monitor your emails and check our website for upcoming teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.